So let's roll the tape. My name is Barbara Collins, and I teach at California Lutheran University. I teach microbiology, among other things. In fact, someone greeted me this morning and wanted to know if I was the person who taught everything. Well, not quite everything, but quite a few different topics. My topic this morning is don't let them get you. And what I'm going to be talking about are bacteria and virus, some of the diseases that are lurking around. And of course, the bacteria and virus are ever ready to attack, and we have to get all out our forces to prevent it. And there are things that we can do. There are ways that we can avoid some of them, certainly. What I want to do first is talk about the bacteria. I want to talk about bacteria first in water, then I'll mention milk, then we'll talk about food and wounds. I want to talk about some of the common things that you might pick up or maybe wise practices that you might use. Then after we finish with the bacteria, then we'll get into virus, we'll talk about the common cold, and then we'll end up with AIDS, which is probably can go on for forever. Incidentally, I was talking to Jerry, and there's a possibility of having a forum maybe next week on AIDS for anyone who might be here. But anyhow, let's get into the bacteria. First off, I want to talk about water. A lot of bacteria can be carried in water, and so it would be certainly a possibility of contacting some diseases this way. For example, you've heard of getting typhoid, cholera, dysentery. Many of these things are carried in water. Now, normally here in the States, there's no problem in drinking water. If you live in one of the cities or whatever, usually your drinking water is perfectly safe and there's no real problem. However, if you do live out in the country and you have your own well water, then you want to be very careful that someone's septic tank isn't leaking into your well supply, and then it would be a good idea to have a bacteriological check for the water. Otherwise, normally no problem, maybe unless we had some kind of catastrophe like an earthquake, and you might hear again that the drinking water is not safe, in which case then boil your water. Okay, I want to talk a little bit about boiling, sterilization, pasteurization. These are terms that might be good to know about. When we use the term sterilize, we mean that we're killing all forms of life. And to sterilize, boiling is not sufficient. So a lot of times, you know, you come home from the hospital with a newborn baby and they say, sterilize the baby bottles. Well, actually, you don't sterilize the baby bottles. To do that, you'd have to put them in a we do it in an autoclave, but a pressure cooker would suffice, 15 pounds pressure for 15 minutes. In other words, to kill all forms of life, you need a temperature more than boiling. Boiling is only 100 degrees centigrade. To sterilize, you need 121. However, then, is boiling your water going to be okay because we're not sterilizing it, we're not doing it in a pressure cooker? Yes, boiling is okay. The reason being because you will kill what we call the vegetative forms, the bacteria that's swimming around in the water. You're going to kill those, and those are the ones that you're worried about. What you will not kill would be spores. And for just practical purposes, if you're going to drink the water, the presence of spores in the water is not going to matter. There's one time that the presence of spores is going to matter, and that's when you're canning food. And I'm going to talk about that later when we get into food, because I'm sure you've heard about botulism. And then it is very, very important that you more than boil, that you do sterilize. Otherwise, if you're just going to drink the water, boiling is sufficient. Now, in milk, we pasteurize. We don't even bring it up to boiling temperature. We're killing then only the pathogens, the ones that cause disease. And we're letting other bacteria live. That's why your milk goes sour in the refrigerator. So we're not killing certain bacteria, but killing those that cause disease. And I'll get back to milk in a bit. So anyway, boiling the water is sufficient. Now, what I really wanted to talk about was thing like, supposing you're hiking around here, you're hiking in the Sierras. Do you drink the water or don't you drink the water? What precautions do you need to take? Is there danger of getting anything? Now, if you're hiking in the Sierras, there's danger of getting the organism called Giardia. Maybe some of you have been in the Sierras. Maybe if you've been warned about not drinking the water. Back east also, there's a problem. I have not heard of any particular problem up here. However, it's good to follow certain precautions when you are hiking and are drinking the water. Particularly in the Sierras, they will tell you not to drink the water unless you boil it first. However, sometimes it may be difficult if you're hiking at high elevation to have the facilities for heating the water sufficiently and so on. Also, if you're just doing a one-day stint, you don't want to maybe carry up facilities for boiling water, and maybe you can't carry enough water with you. If a general rule of thumb, if the water is running rapidly and aerating with sunshine, it's probably okay. But a good rule of thumb, never drink from a still body of water, lake or otherwise, no matter where you are. It's best not to, unless you do either boil the water, or you can buy these little iodine tablets, which you can put in. If you follow the directions as what it says, it is safe. We've checked it, and it does kill the pathogenic organism. So you can either bring the tablet with you, heat the water to boiling. But otherwise, don't drink from a lake. Drink from rapidly running water. Yeah, question? Pardon me?
What about the filters that you can buy? Filter the water.
I don't know. What kind of filter is it? And you bring it up in the mountains with you, or what kind of filter is it?
You take it hiking with you, and you pump the water through.
Okay, yeah. If it just goes through, it will not be sufficient. But if it's a very fine filter and you're forcing the water through, then that's probably okay too. Right. However, if it were a virus problem, that would not be, it would not protect against that. But I would suspect it would probably be okay.
Yeah. There are some problems with the audience here.
Oh, there are. In which case, then I would follow the precaution, never drink from the lakes. It was interesting. One time, I remember it must have been about 12, 14 years ago, we hiked up to Holden Lake, and we did not get water from the stream, didn't think about it. And there we are at the lake and suddenly realize we don't have enough water. We had this little Kool-Aid to make water. And so there we are dying of thirst. And then after a few minutes, we knowed some friends over there on the rock. And we asked them whether they had anything to drink. They said, oh yeah, we got lots of Kool-Aid. And so we drank healthily from their Kool-Aid. They had a big jug of it. And so we had quite a bit. And then I said, we brought the Kool-Aid up, but we didn't have any water, and I didn't want to collect anything out of the lake. And they said, well, you've just drunk the lake water. And I'm thinking, oh, no. We did survive, but it's not a good policy. The reason being, if the water is still, is sitting there, the sun shines on it, can warm up, particularly where you're going to be collecting near the edge, the bacteria will grow, they'll multiply, and you'll have a greater concentration there. It isn't that they might not be in the running water, but it will be much sparser concentration. And the sunlight does have a purifying effect. The sun will sterilize. We've done experiments holding water out in the sunlight, and it does sterilize. So remember that. Hanging the clothes out isn't that bad, because it does have a good effect. Okay. So that's about the water, and mostly your real problem in any kind of water is human contamination, or in other words, what's above where you're getting the water from is the big question. Okay, let me move on just briefly to milk. Pasteurizing milk kills the pathogens, and so your pasteurized milk is safe. Some people like to drink raw certified milk. In most cases, probably all right. I prefer not to, because there is that element of danger. When they check the milk, they're not checking for particular pathogens. They're checking for a certain number of organisms. So there's a certain number per milliliter. Well, maybe that number that they have could be pathogens, though. So there, and apparently, supposedly, the listeriosis, the problem there in the cheese was that it was made from unpasteurized milk. So it is a good... I think I just go ahead with the pasteurized milk, maybe. There could be benefits from unpasteurized, but I think the good of the pasteurized more than outweighs that. Okay, let me move on to food. One thing to...
What's the temperature of pasteurization?
It's...
160?
Oh, gee. I can't remember the Fahrenheit. It's... usually, it depends on whether it's a slow or a rapid. Sometimes it's up to 72 centigrade, and I'm not sure. It would be something like that in Fahrenheit. Not sure what the temperature is in Fahrenheit. Okay, what about bacteria in food? That can be a real problem. I want to tell you, give you a couple of little stories. One's the Sunday school picnic syndrome, and the other's the green bean story. All my students hear about these little stories. One thing to bear in mind about bacteria, the doubling time for bacteria is something like 20 minutes. 20 minutes, 30 minutes. Okay, now what's that mean? Now that isn't all the time, not in the refrigerator. But this is out on the shelf, incubating, room temperature. Okay, well, what do we mean then? One bacteria, in 20 minutes you got two. Well, that's nothing to worry about, no biggie. In another 20 minutes, you've got four. In another 20 minutes, eight. But wait till you get up to 1,000, 2,000, 4,000, 8,000, 16,000, 32,000. So you're going to reach a point when you're doubling them, and you're getting up in high numbers. All right, so that we have to bear that in mind. And when do you have this problem? That's when it's at good incubation temperature, and room temperature can be that. Of course, the best temperature for the pathogens is probably 98.6. Strange, isn't that? But that's the best temperature for the pathogens. But they do fine at room temperature. We always grow our bacteria at room temperature, and they do very well. So bear this in mind with food. Okay, how did the bacteria get there in the first place? Well, they could have been there from the person who, if it's meat, well, mention how it gets on that. Initially, from the preparation of the meat, it can be there. How long has it been sitting around? And then just any kind of contact with humans can get bacteria or bacteria present on the meat. Okay, let's talk about the Sunday school picnic syndrome. Okay, Mrs. Jones, she has had a little stomach upset, you know, hasn't been feeling too well. And there's this big Saturday Sunday school picnic, it's the 4th of July or whatever, you know. And all the kids and everything are going, and she has to bring some food. So she decides potato salad sounds good. So that's what she's going to bring. And so she gets up early Saturday morning because she hasn't really felt well enough to put it together earlier. She boils up the potatoes, and since everyone's in a big old rush to go, there isn't time to refrigerate anything, so she boils the potatoes and mixes in mayonnaise and maybe a little ham and a few other odds and ends and some celery and maybe some onions and mixes up maybe some eggs, you know, nice potato salad, nice. And since they're all in a big rush, she really hasn't had time to refrigerate it that much. Maybe she pokes it in the refrigerator for a few minutes. And so it probably isn't terribly cold when they start. Well, best to put a Saran wrap over the top to keep the flies and everything off it, and off to the picnic. Well, it happens to be a nice hot day. You know how hot the car can get. So I imagine that potato salad has begun to incubate while they're en route. And the drive, you know, in and out and around probably takes maybe an hour. So there it has been sitting in the back seat, not in the sun. They've been real careful to keep it in the shade, and off to the picnic. So there we are, finally at the picnic, and the men and the boys, let's have a softball game first. So the women sit around the table, and we put the food right out in the middle of the table, and it's still pretty warm, and everything's carefully, and they swat the flies away and everything, and there the food sits and incubates. Perhaps the game goes on for an hour and a half, and pretty soon it's time to eat. And so everyone digs in heartily into this potato salad, which we didn't do a bacteria count on, but I imagine it could be pretty healthy by the time people get around to eating some of the food. And then strangely, the next day, everyone comes down with the same thing. And what happened? Well, incubation temperature, 2 hours, 3 hours, and so on. So. We're always wary when we go to these Sunday school potluck dinners and our church potluck dinners in the summertime. Then you have to be really picky about what you're going to eat. I remember one time being there, and I asked this man, "Oh, where's your wife?" "Oh, she wasn't feeling too well, but she made up a salad, and she made up a salad for us." And I'm thinking, "Oh my goodness, which one was it?" so I can be sure to avoid it. So there's sometimes, you know, you wonder, well, maybe I just better play it safe with the fruit. Fruit's pretty safe, usually, in comparison to some of this other stuff. Acid fruit tends to kill your bacteria, so you're much safer with that kind of thing. So look at it carefully and wonder. And it isn't just that kind. You can be hit in a restaurant or otherwise. I'll mention again what are your safer foods. I remember being in North Carolina one summer, really hot and muggy. And that was a few years back. I don't know whether the conditions are any better. Really primitive. Even in the hospital, you hardly dared to eat because there was no air conditioning. We'd often sometimes go there in the cafeteria, and I didn't really feel terribly safe there. You can almost have this odor emanating, and you wondered, boy, that smells like E. coli. And E. coli is, if you're familiar with a bacteria that's present in your human fecal material. And you sort of wonder about the sanitation conditions then. Well, anyway, a lot of times we'd go, rather than going to the regular cafeteria, we'd go to this little A&P kind of market. Now, I remember going in there and you'd see all these sandwiches all wrapped up sitting there, but the place was hot. I mean, there was no air conditioning and it was just sitting, you know, it was covered glass, but they could reach in easily, but there was no refrigeration. And the thing that got me, I had no idea when those sandwiches were placed there. That morning, 3 days ago, a week ago. I mean, there was no way of guessing. I think I'll pass on those. The only thing I dared to eat was I'd get a box of cornflakes or a product 19 or 17 or whatever. Get a little box of cereal and then have milk. And I figured, well, the milk's bad. I knew the milk was refrigerated because they pulled it out where the ice cream was. And I figured, well, if that's not safe, I'll know because, you know, it'll be sour and you'll know automatically. So I played it safe with that kind of stuff, dried foods, but there was no way I was going to touch one of the sandwiches. One of the girls went in one of these fancier restaurants and had a chef's salad, and she was laid under for the rest of the session. So you can, even in some restaurants, it can be somewhat dangerous.
Is it a particular bacteria that causes the...
Yeah, two kinds. One is staph. There's staph food poisoning and there's salmonella food poisoning. The staph is called the Roto-Rooter disease. That's the one that within 4 hours, 6 hours, something like that, you're throwing up both ends, you know, coming out one end and throwing up the other. That would be the staph food poisoning. Salmonella is a little more subtle. That one probably 24 hours before you get the first symptoms, and that one is severe diarrhea, severe stomach cramps. Can be serious, can even cause hospitalization because of dehydration. So salmonella or staph are the two most common. There's one other you've heard of as botulism. Now that, in most cases, you don't have to worry about, but let me tell you how you can prevent having that problem. Botulism is caused by a bacteria, we call it Clostridium, and it's anaerobic. In other words, it doesn't grow where there's air. So if you have aeration, there's no problem with that bacteria growing. And it isn't the bacteria in you that causes the problem, it's the toxin it produces. Clostridium can produce the most deadly toxin known to mankind, deadlier than the stuff we brew up in the chem lab. A teaspoonful could wipe out the population. Well, usually the population here and probably a good part of the country. So a very, very potent substance. Okay, what do you need? You need the bacteria, anaerobic conditions, you need food for it to eat, and then keep those anaerobic conditions. It will produce the toxin. Then all you have to do is ingest the toxin. Okay, the best way of doing this is canning food improperly, because when the food is canned, you have a vacuum. If you have not killed the spores, this is where we have spores, if you haven't killed the spores, they will grow, they'll germinate, and the bacteria will grow, begin to produce the toxin, and that will be in your canned food. Even a taste could be enough to kill you if the toxin is there. So, the moral of the story is, if you have a can that is bulged, throw it out, don't even open it. Don't ever think of tasting it, just throw it out. The amount it costs to throw out that can is nothing compared to what your hospital bill is going to be if you get botulism. I'm not saying necessarily, but usually if the organism's there, it also produces gas and it could cause a bulging of your can. So if can looks anything suspect, I'd give it a toss. Not worth it. Okay. Now your own home canning, if you do your own home canning, it's very, very important that you do it properly. Okay, supposing green beans, that's a mild kind of food that could conceivably have the organism on it. Where do the spores come from? They would be on the soil. They could be anywhere in your yard. So a little dirt you see on the green beans, and chances are you might not get all the spores off. Okay, you start canning your green beans and you do not use a pressure cooker. Then you see you are not sterilizing. Boiling does not do it. You can boil it on the stove all day. It's not going to kill the spores. You must use a pressure cooker. And you must cook 15 pounds pressure, 15 minutes. You must adequately sterilize. If not, then you've got a vacuum. You've got the spores. They will germinate. You open up the jar later, and you could have the toxin there. Okay, I always tell my kids this story. Supposing now you're going to have a little dinner and you invite the next door neighbors and she brings over a little jar of her home canned green beans and to have with the dinner. And you're wondering, oh my goodness. So then you say, oh, how nice. I just love canned green beans. How do you do it? I've never really done it before. And then you find then she said, oh, it's really easy. You just boil it on the stove, you know, and you cover it up and there you are. Then you're thinking, that's nice. And then you proceed, you open up the can and don't ever taste it, remember. But if you boil the substance for 10 minutes, you can detoxify the toxin. So actually, I would probably inform her that, well, that's not too safe. But anyway, you can go ahead and boil it before you taste it or anything. So set it on the stove, you know, and go out, oh, would you like to see my backyard? And leave the green beans boiling for a bit. But seriously, though, fruit, usually less of a problem. Acid substances, less of a problem than a mild kind of thing. As far as canned foods in the grocery store, I don't think you have any problem there. They have very well checked up. It would be most likely your own home canning. Okay, let me mention about salmonella, because I think that's a real problem today. Particularly chicken, poultry, but also present in meats. All right, when you buy the chicken in the store, it is very likely contaminated with salmonella already. I can't tell you what the count's going to be, but likely there will be salmonella on it already. The count, how many bacteria on the chicken would depend upon how long it's been sitting there before you actually bought it, how long it's been sitting out. Okay, why does it have salmonella on? It's the way they do the preparation of the chicken nowadays. So we have checked a lot of chicken bacteria, and we almost always pick up salmonella on it. Okay, therefore, the best thing to do is to pretend that there is salmonella on the chicken and treat it accordingly. Okay, which would mean that the juice has salmonella on it also. Therefore, you can prepare your chicken and everything, get it ready. You must cook it thoroughly. Be sure that you are not eating raw chicken or rare chicken. Be sure that you do cook it thoroughly, that it reaches an appropriate temperature in the center to kill any potential bacteria. Okay, one of the real problems is the fact that people don't realize that the juice, you see, could contain the salmonella. And so if you're cutting it on the shelf, on your counter, be sure that you don't then, before you wash off your counter, start chopping lettuce that then you are going to be eating raw that's not going to be cooked. So be sure and that you wash your hands thoroughly. So otherwise there should be no problem, but just be sure that you do cook your chicken thoroughly and that you don't leave the chicken juice around, that you do wash your counter. Yeah.
How much bacteria are you talking about? Sorry, 1,000
mils? Yeah, well, that's another factor too. The dosage that you get would determine It would certainly be a factor, and I can't tell you how many per milliliter, but probably certainly more than 5 or 10. You'd probably have to be up in the 10,000 or something like that, in the thousands. Depends on your condition, too.
Is that a problem if you cut it on a cutting board and then just wash it with soap and water, then it's dead and it's gone?
I would think, cutting board, I usually just use a regular counter because it's easier to clean off. A cutting board, thing juice can sort of sink in, and a good thing if it can dry off is good because most bacteria require the moisture for survival. The dryness is good because that enables the killing of it. I don't know, I would like to use a counter more often, something that you're sure that you can get the juice off.
What about these plastic things that you cutting boards?
The plastic what?
They're plastic boards instead of wooden.
Oh, yeah, that would be okay, too, I would think, because the wooden is the thing that the juice would sink into. So I'm just not too sure about that.
Well, the health department says plastic, so I'm assuming.
Yeah, I would assume that that would be fine. It would just be like a counter or something that you could easily clean off, right? What about eating in restaurants and whatever? Is there much danger here? Sometimes it can be. Check out your restaurant. Some of these fancy ones, just because you pay more money for the food doesn't necessarily mean the food's going to be any better or safer. In most cases, not that way. Some of the cheaper places are generally safer. Now, we've checked, we like to check the local eating establishments around Thousand Oaks, and we have found that McDonald's, believe it or not, comes out very, very low count. Some other restaurants sometimes come out rather high. One time we were checking utensils, and one of the students, I guess, asked for a glass, and they pulled one out of the refrigerator. They heard that we were checking for bacteria, so they bring us a special glass pulled out from the refrigerator. That's pretty funny. Incidentally, concerning refrigeration will stop the growth of pathogens. So after having a turkey dinner or whatever, refrigerate. Do not leave it sitting out on the shelf for whatever. People want to nibble on it, later in the evening. You should refrigerate as soon as possible. Then it stops the growth of your pathogens.
I have a question. We used to be told to cool the food before you covered it to put in the refrigerator. Now they say to cover it and put it right in. You're not going to increase the pathogens by covering a warm food?
See, when you cover it, you tend to hold in the heat a bit, but it should cool as soon as possible, I would think. And I would think so. I mean, not boiling hot, obviously. What you can do is cool it till a point that you would think most of the pathogens are killed, probably 50 degrees centigrade. So once it's cool enough that you think that they're not going to be living, then I would go ahead and refrigerate as soon as possible.
Yeah. It's also important not to refrigerate huge things of soup or huge things or whatever, because it just will not cool down fast enough in the refrigerator. If you're going to cool something, it needs to be in the shallow can.
Yeah, put it in smaller containers, because it will cool a lot. If you have a large volume, that's true, it takes a much longer time to cool. Be much better in smaller potions to do that.
I was told that, how refrigerators have places to put eggs in the door.
Mm-hmm.
And I was told that wasn't very good, that you're supposed to keep your eggs in the refrigerator. I was wondering if that's true.
Well, we've kept ours there and we haven't had a real problem. It should be, I'm sure it isn't quite as cold as the rest refrigerator, but isn't it reasonably cold? I don't know.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
I would think it's probably okay, maybe better in the refrigerator proper, but I think most refrigerators, it's reasonably cold there,
well,
too.
I think they wouldn't hit the refrigerators if it caused a problem.
Yeah. So we've never had a problem.
I had a question about turtles. It seems like I've heard that pet turtles had salmonella bacteria on them, kids playing with them. Have you heard that?
No, I haven't, but it could be. I don't know. I don't know the answer to that one, but that's a possibility.
Have you heard of a salmonella being passed on to eggs or chickens?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Combat that problem.
I guess, again, it would be the same thing. Cook, don't eat raw eggs. Because otherwise, as long as you cook your eggs, would be no problem. Because normally, I guess if... I don't think it's that common of a problem, but I think it could be a possibility in some cases.
On the shell of the egg, you're touching the outside of the egg.
No, I don't think that's probably that big of a problem, but it's always a good thing when you are preparing food to wash your hands frequently so that, particularly before you're going to be making something that you're going to be eating that you're not cooking afterwards. For example, when you're making a salad, you're doing anything like that, it's good policy to just wash your hands before you make something that you're going to be eating directly.
Is mold on food indicative of pathogens?
No, usually not. Grow well in the refrigerator, and so they will. Pardon?
In the freezer. I've had mold on bread in the freezer. That's all. And I went to a co-op, and all the bread in the freezer had mold.
Wow. Mm. Yeah, because usually the freezer will stop the growth, but it doesn't kill anything. But usually it will stop the growth. But mold does well in the refrigerator. It won't hurt you, no, in most cases, particularly bread. No, most of it's penicillium, which we use penicillin as an antibiotic. Most of the molds, I can't. Aspergillus, in some cases, could be harmful, but most cases, probably just scrape the mold off and it's fine. Usually, if it tastes funny, then I certainly wouldn't eat it, but it isn't that kind of a thing that you're going to have to worry that much about. No, because the penicillin that you take as an antibiotic is very concentrated, and the mold on the cheese would have just a very, very tiny. It would not be enough to harm. The amount that you would get in that mold on the cheese would be almost nothing in comparison to what you would take in a pill. I might, maybe at this point, since the penicillin has been brought out, let me mention a few things about antibiotics. You take antibiotics for bacterial infections. And before the advent of antibiotics, diseases like pneumonia and some other diseases would be almost always fatal or frequently fatal. But now you're almost better off if you have pneumonia than if you have the common cold. You know, you take the antibiotic and you're fine. So the antibiotics, they're produced by living things, and they combat the pathogens. And so some common antibiotics would be penicillin, streptomycin, chloramphenicol, a whole bunch of different ones. Okay, they're great. However, there are problems with overuse of antibiotics or improper use. First off, the antibiotic will not harm virus. They're not. They will not attack the virus. So if you take an antibiotic for a virus infection, it could be very undesirable for a variety of reasons. Number one, overabundance of antibiotics, the bacteria become resistant to them. All right, there's a huge number of bacteria, and perhaps you have an infection. Could be very likely that one in those billions could be resistant to the antibiotic. Okay, you wipe out all the others, but this one you're not wiping out. It divides and you've got 2, 4, 8, 16, you know, and before long you've got a whole population of them. And so if we have too free use of antibiotics, all the bacteria in existence would be resistant to them. And it's just common sense. So the moral of the story is any antibiotic you buy in the open market has got to be pretty much useless because it's been around long enough that every self-respecting bacteria would be resistant to it. Anything that isn't resistant would long since have been gone. All right, so when you take the antibiotics, it's very important that you follow the directions carefully of the physician, that you take them till they're all gone, if that's what the directions say. Because a lot of times, you know, you'll take a few, you know, for about 3 days. Oh, I feel fine, you know. I think I'll leave the rest for, I'll get another infection probably another 6 months. Or my husband, he's got the same thing. I'll give him the rest and you know, save the doctor bill. The problem is then you are promoting resistance. So it's best to get rid of them. And if you have not, go back to the doctor so you get a different antibiotic to get rid of whatever it is. So don't just take them when unnecessary, without a doctor's prescription or whatever. They're not pain pills, and they won't get rid of the pain or anything. They are for a bacterial infection, and they're not for the common cold. Another problem with antibiotics, if you take them when you don't need them, they'll also kill your bacteria inside your system, the good ones. There are good ones and bad ones. Okay, so if you wipe out the good guys, cleaning house, so to speak, as it says in the Bible, what's going to happen? If you don't replace it with good ones, the bad guys are going to take over, and you could end up with something worse than what you started with. This is where yeast infections come in. Yeast are not harmed by the antibiotic. Your own host bacteria are. Therefore, if you wipe them out, the yeast, which is a very slow grower, can then sort of take over, and you could end up then with a yeast infection. So you do have to be careful with the use of antibiotics. I recommend, generally, if you are taking antibiotics, take drink buttermilk, take yogurt, something like that, to resupply a culture of bacteria in your intestines to replace what you're wiping out. So yogurt, acidophilus milk, some of those kinds of things. Okay, let me mention a few things about wounds, and then we'll move into the common cold. First, about wounds. Probably two common bacteria that could cause severe infections. One would be staph again. Another could be Pseudomonas. Pseudomonas is a little more problematic. Well, both of them can be quite serious. How do we get infections of wounds? Well, basically, our skin gives a good protection against bacteria. Once you scrape off that surface of skin, then you're vulnerable to all kinds of bacteria. They're in the air, they're in dirt, and whatever, and it's very difficult to be sure that you have removed all bacteria. Okay, supposing you fall and you get a nice scrape, not really deep, but you know, a scrape on your leg. I always used to do this. I'd go roller skating down the middle of the street, invariably fall, and we have one of those streets with all the tar and all the little cinders and everything, and you'd have cinders in your leg and whatever. Well, try to clean it out as best you can. But the very worst thing you can do is then put some kind of ointment on. You can, whatever you want to get. The worst thing you can do is put the ointment on and then cover it with a bandage, which is what most people do. That's the very worst thing you can probably do, because you're keeping it moist, dark, warm. Exactly what the bacteria like. Room temperature, they're going to just go to town. Likely you've not killed all the bacteria with your washing or whatever treatment. Then if you keep it warm and moist, you're going to grow and almost invariably get a nice infection. The best thing to do is to keep it exposed as much as possible. Again, dryness will kill the bacteria. Sunshine has a killing effect, ultraviolet radiation. So fresh air and sunshine is your best thing. Not stay away from the Band-Aid if at all possible. If it's on your feet, obviously then you have to prevent abrasion, but be sure you take that Band-Aid off as soon as you're home and air the wound. The more you can air it, the better off you'll be. And once you can get that dry scab over, you're all set. But once it's exposed, you're in danger.
Yeah, that happens a lot when you're camping. You tend to get scraped up more, and then it tends to get dirty real fast.
Mm-hmm.
So then would you cover it, or would you still leave it open and then just clean it?
Keeping it open, it depends on where the wound is. At some place, you know, that gets really dirty, then I suppose you may have to cover it some of the time. But again, the more you can keep it exposed, the better. I guess you have to use your common sense as to how dirty it's getting. But again, the more you can air it, because you want to get it dry and you want to get the sunlight to it. But there are times, yeah, you do have to wrap it. But then be sure that you don't leave that bandage on for a long period of time. Some people put a bandage on, you know, leave it on for a day or two, and then when you take it off, you've got a nice infection there. So those are kinds of things. Tetanus. What about tetanus? You all hear about that. It's a different kind of a thing. That's a bacteria that, again, it's the same Clostridium. In this case, it's anaerobic. It requires conditions in which you have no oxygen. You have the bacteria, it's a spore again, which could be found on dirt or rusty nails, that kind of thing. And no air, and then it likewise grows and it produces a toxin, which then gives you tetanus. Now, in the old days, you used to wait until you stepped on the rusty nail, and then you'd go get your tetanus shot. But nowadays, of course, everyone has a tetanus shot, and the smart thing to do is to have your tetanus shot and keep it up to date. Don't wait to step on the rusty nail, because sometimes it could be just a thumbtack, and you might not even realize that you could be infected. It's a puncture wound that you don't get the air to, and so it's anaerobic, and so then again, you could get an infection. So as long as you have kept up with your tetanus shot, there's no problem. Actually, if you were to step on a rusty nail and you had not had a tetanus shot at all, you might not have enough time to build up the antibodies to prevent getting tetanus. Okay, let's move on to some of the virus infections. There are two kinds of virus infections. One we call virulent, that's an active one. The other is a temperate, sort of a resting kind of state. The virulent one, the virus attacks the cell, it multiplies in the cell, and usually destroys the cell, and then all the virus are out. If you thought the bacteria grew well, you haven't heard anything compared to virus. They'll attack the cell, and within 20 minutes to half an hour, you have not two cells, two virus particles, you may have 200 or 300. So in 30 minutes, you've gone from 1 to 300. So that's a little more efficient. So that's why a virus infection can go quite fast. Others can be slow. It depends on the particular virus. All right, the common cold is a typical virulent infection. They did some studying over in England working with the common cold virus. Very difficult to get the thing growing. And they discovered that the reason was they were trying to grow it at body temperature 98.6. And apparently it grows better at a slightly lower temperature. And so that's where the virus is, you see, in the respiratory. So it likes just a little slightly cooler temperature. Well, they were growing the virus, and what they wanted to do was to find out susceptibility. And they're also looking for a vaccination to see if there's a vaccine for the common cold. They had a bunch of volunteers. They were mostly from the jails. And they had a bunch of volunteers that they used, and they came out with some interesting results. You always hear people talking about, oh, I was in this draft last night and I came down with a cold. Or I got my feet wet and then I got a cold. And they did all this experimenting, and you do not get a cold from sitting in the wind. I mean, how many times have you been out in the wind? Like, there's a lot of wind out here and you don't get a cold. Or a lot of times you get your feet wet and you do not get a cold. To get the cold, you need two factors. First off, you've got to be exposed. You must be exposed to that cold virus. That's thing number one. You would need, of course, enough of the exposure. And then number two is your bodily condition at the time. Now, if you have not been getting enough sleep, you've been under stress, your food eating habits have not been good, those are all factors that could make you in a rundown condition and you would get the cold. If you have a large enough exposure, you'll probably get it anyway. Now, how do you get exposed to the cold? Well, obviously, if you're with somebody who has the cold. And the worst is if you're a kindergarten teacher, or first grade, second grade, because those kids will come in with a cold and it's all over. It's on there. Usually, they say that the most common way of getting the cold is through the hands. You know, some of the kids, you know, come along, their nose is dripping, you know, and their hands are all contaminated. And I think it's a losing battle, I think, if you're probably kindergarten, first grade, second grade. And when you have your own kids, you know, a cold goes through the whole family. It's really hard to prevent. But it's very important that, I guess, you have to wash your hands just all the time. It's just a really losing battle. And to teach the kids that not to have this wet handkerchief sitting around the house and whatever, you know, in the fringe. But so those are some of the problems. Now, I said that I was going to talk about AIDS. Let me throw out a few little things about that. AIDS is a different kind of infection. It isn't what we call the virulent one, at least initially. Different thing happens. AIDS is caused by a virus. It enters the cell, but then it actually attaches to the host chromosome and becomes part of the chromosome itself. And there it remains. And so, of course, if the cell were to divide, it would still be there. But anyhow, then it attaches to the chromosome. Now, you've heard of the tests. We give a test for determining if a person has been infected. Apparently, once the virus is in the cell, then it causes a change in that cell. An antigen, a special antigen, is produced that then is on the surface of that cell. And so we are looking for the presence of this antigen. Okay, so an infected cell then is sort of marked. All right, so we can tell if a person has been infected with AIDS and they may have no symptoms whatsoever. Then sometime later, which could be quite a few years later, they may develop then the full-fledged symptoms of AIDS. And at this point, then many of the cells have been destroyed. And I'm going to mention a bit what kind of cell and what happens. And so at that point then, they would experience the symptoms that we call. The symptoms that they have would be infections with very unusual diseases you would not normally get. For example, pneumocystis pneumonia is one of the common diseases. Now, no one otherwise would have that disease. The reason being is that the virus itself, the AIDS virus, attacks what we call the T cell. We have two kinds of immunity. One immunity we call humoral, and it's in the blood. It's the antibodies in the blood. And that combats all the bacteria, the run-of-the-mill diseases like pneumonia and so on. That's what we have the vaccine. We may have some vaccinations for certain diseases. The other kind of immunity is called T-cell immunity, and it's a cellular immunity. The T-cells attack cells that have been infected. Okay, so the virus is attacking the T cell, and so it's upsetting that whole T cell immunity because the virus is attacking the cell that would normally attack it. And it's destroying those cells. And so there's no way that the body can combat this. All right, the kind of thing now that the diseases you get then are diseases that normally the T cells are going to take care of. So if you all get this protozoa pneumocystis, normally your T cells are going to kill any cell that's infected. But now the T cells are killing your own cells because you're killing your own T cells. And it's a thing that's almost self-defeating in a sense. And there are many ways the antigen is present on an infected cell. So an uninfected cell will come and engulf it, and then that becomes destroyed too. Or healthy cells will clump together, and then you have one big clump of infected cells. So it gradually, the whole process gradually spreads. The thing is, I had thought that it's just a chance, like syphilis, you go through the first stage and the second stage, and then maybe you reach this point, and then you reach full-fledged AIDS. But apparently, they have done some studying at Johns Hopkins with people that known infected and studying them all along the line. And they've discovered that initially, when you test positive for AIDS, in other words, that you have been infected, you have a reasonably good T cell count. No symptoms at this point. In other words, I'm okay, I'm fine. But they have tested these people along the line, and 2 years later, that T cell count is down, even though the person says they're fine and they're healthy. The T cell count has gone down. There are no symptoms still. Still, again, some years later, they begin to get swollen glands, but still okay, and they don't, still supposedly fine. But gradually, apparently, it's a gradual progression, and eventually you reach a point that the T cell count is very low, and that's when you begin to pick up the particular disease, the full-fledged AIDS infection. It said when you reach a certain point that the T cells are very, very much depleted. What are the diseases you get? Well, pneumocystis is a very common one. Another one is a cancer. And cancer, if you are familiar, again, is a problem with the cell itself. Cancer, the situation, and again, it's a chromosomal thing, that the cell, the information on the chromosome is faulty so that the cell divides and it continues to divide. And you get that 2, 4, 8, 16 kind of thing again. May not be a rapid division, but it continues to divide. Now, what causes that? It's some faulty information on the DNA, and so the cell divides and it keeps dividing. Normally, after a certain point, we call it contact inhibition. You have a certain number of cells, and that's it. You know, you get a tissue, and that's it. They don't continue to divide. Or they mature and carry on a function. But when you have cancer, there is no contact inhibition. They just keep dividing, piling on top of each other, and you're getting this bigger mass. There's no inhibition that prevents that growth. Then the problem with the cancer, too, is the fact that some cells will break away, metastasis we call this, and they'll travel around in the bloodstream to other areas and then start the same thing. 1, 2, 4, 8, 16. Now, they'll initially get caught in the lymph nodes, but eventually they'll escape and travel around. Okay, what can you do? This is sort of a slight diversion. What can you do about a cancer is if it can be removed initially before that metastasis occurs, you can have 100% cure. Or if you can hope to remove them all or through radiation on the lymph nodes or such, you can hope for a cure. The problem with radiation is, though, that that also causes mutations, and you could cause a cancer in the process of trying to cure it. But anyway, back to AIDS. One of the cancers that you get is called Kaposi's sarcoma, a very typical thing. And a third thing that you might get with AIDS, a very common one, is thrush or yeast infection. Again, these are kinds of things that normally would not occur, but you get these. It's rather interesting. AIDS first appeared in probably developed in Africa. And it was interesting, up till probably about 2 years ago, Africa claimed there were no cases of AIDS in Africa. People from Africa then went to England and were diagnosed as having AIDS. They called it slim disease in Africa, but no AIDS here, it's slim disease. The reason being, a person with AIDS loses weight, you have diarrhea and so on, and so people were wasting away, so they just called it slim disease. But they would not admit they had AIDS because they didn't want people not to come to Africa. So, but now, of course, it's a large percentage of people do have AIDS. The AIDS in Africa is a little bit different. There are equal number almost of male and female, and a lot of heterosexual transmission. Here in the States, it is largely through homosexual. Transmission of AIDS through blood, semen, through sexual transmission. The amount of AIDS present in saliva, the amount of the virus present in saliva, very, very, very minute, and your chances of getting through that is virtually nil. It would be through blood or any kind of thing like that of getting the disease. Have I mentioned everything about it? So as far as AIDS is concerned, the virus then is a different kind of virus. It's a slower acting in the sense, but it's within the cell, and but a slow removal of the T cells. And according to the study at Johns Hopkins, it isn't just a chancy thing that all of a sudden you become with active AIDS. It's a gradual progression that you get to that point.
So what is it that you do?
I'm not sure what actually happens, but again, it's attacking the organism, and I guess it, in some cases, it does help stop that cycle for a bit. Yes, right, yes. Because what the thing is, hoping that they can slow that or, you know, prevent this progression that seems to be occurring.
The progression to the symptoms, does that always happen eventually?
It seemed to in the study that no one is immune. It's just a matter of how long it will take. Of course, the hope is that we can find a substance that can prevent that progression, you see. But according to their study, it seemed that it did occur, and it was just a regular progressive thing. And if we could get something that would stop that progression, you see.
I'm an educator, and it's becoming a real big deal in the schools about having an immune challenge.
Mm-hmm.
Or and then that would work with food, and then
I know, it's really hard because a lot of people are... Yeah, I don't think there is any danger with anyone involved, but it's an education kind of thing, because I know people are frightened to death and they're afraid that, you know, just saliva or drinking out of the same drinking cup, and that will not happen. That will not happen. It has to be really broken through blood transmission, really. And I would think in the contact in the schools, this really would not be a situation. And even in homes in which a child or someone has been infected with AIDS, the family does not contact it.
Does the family have to be careful with the blood that person? Because I've heard nurses who work with these patients, and I said, if you're using needles, you better know who's piercing your ears.
Oh, yeah.
They aren't careful and use new needles. I mean, a little thing like this, a lot of people just pull them out of the ears. That's one way to pass them. And I know that when I go to the doctor, the dentist, I mean, they're all wearing gloves now. They don't touch anything.
Oh, I know for certain, because who do you know? I mean, how can you know whether they have been infected or not? They may or may not have symptoms, and there'd be no way. I would definitely think, yes, if there was someone in the family with AIDS, you would have to be very, very careful with any blood. But for normal saliva, normal contact, no, it should not be a problem. Yes.
Are you familiar with any of the statistics as to how fast this epidemic is growing? And
gee, if I had known I was going to be talking about AIDS, yeah, I have a whole bunch of statistics at home, but I did not bring them here. And the estimates are not that good. It is progressing quite rapidly, and particularly in, you know, the larger city areas, a very rapid progression. So it's something that I think we definitely need to be concerned about. I wish that I had all my statistics with you. I could have told you, you know, the number of cases here now and every year and so on, but I don't have that information with me, so I'm just working on what I can remember. So, but I know that it is becoming a serious thing, certainly, and particularly if the progression increases what it has been doing. So I think education is certainly important, that we educate people on who is at risk and what needs to be done. Are there any other questions? I guess we have time for...
Do you care to comment on the common cup of communion and how that might be a way of passing more life-saving virus or bacteria?
Yeah. Now, you are using alcohol, and there could be a possibility. I would say if you have a cold or you know something's wrong with you, don't drink from the cup. But I could be an ailment, but of course the alcohol can kill organisms. I might mention one thing about cleansing wounds too. We mentioned about it, what is good to use and what isn't. Staff grows. I mean, if we want to select for staff, we use a salt, usually 7.5% salt, because it kills the other bacteria, but the staff do fine, and so you concentrate for staff. So in a dilute salt solution, you're not killing staff. Alcohol, we've checked alcohol, and it isn't that good in killing. They always use you the alcohol, you know, the swab. It doesn't kill much of anything, to be perfectly frank. It maybe emulsifies some of the fat and removes organisms, more cleanser, but it does not kill. The best thing we have always found is hydrogen peroxide. That a very excellent killing. What we do is to dip a little bit of filter paper into the substance we want to check for, and then get off any liquid. And then we make a lawn of bacteria, and then we place that onto the petri dish. We always have a zone of inhibition, a good zone around hydrogen peroxide. Alcohol, next to nothing. Listerine, they literally grow on the filter paper. Hopefully no one here is in the Listerine company. Let me think of some other things. Oh, that neem, what is that stuff that you buy in the little tube? Yeah, that doesn't do anything either. Sounds good, but the bacteria, it doesn't phase them. So hydrogen peroxide in most cases is the best. Another good thing, the thing that they use in the hospital, that iodine compound, now what's betadine? That's good. That works very well.